I want to begin by thanking my good friend Deborah McDowell for hosting this wonderful celebration of the centennial and bringing us all together. And for me, it's always good to come back to the University of Virginia because as a fellow of the Carter G. Woodson Institute, many years ago, the work that I do and have done over the years really took root here, and I'm so happy that some of my fellows, Daryl Scott, Bob Pratt, Ray Gavins, Julian Bond was here back then, and Lara Smith was a young undergraduate, and so it's this is a real special place and a wonderful place to remember and celebrate this history. So thank you all. The ways, in as many of you know, I've been working on history of the NASP for over a decade, and it's really so relevant to many of the questions we're asking today about the ways of the color line and race in American life and what it takes to keep the ideals of democracy alive and organize a sustained challenge to the racial ideas and practices that structure, have structured, and continue to structure much of American life. In the many episodes and things that I learned in writing this book, there's an early episode that kind of stands out. Last night, Julian Bond talked about that it was the boldest and the baddest and organization is, and it was. And this really struck me, thinking about what happened in Memphis in 1914. It was the first time NASP officials traveled to the Deep South to participate in a public meeting. It was a joint meeting of the National Conference of Charities and the Southern Sociological Conference. W.E.B. Du Bois and Joel Spingarn, who had recently been fired from Columbia for protesting university policies, attended the meeting, and they petitioned to have the issue of race placed on the program. The organizers said, no, no, too controversial. Well, Du Bois and Spingarn would not hear of it. They held a breakaway meeting. They got a church, Avery Chapel. Spingarn put up money to take out an ad in every local newspaper in Memphis that invited, sponsored by the NAACP, invited, quote, all persons who love the truth and dare to hear it, are cordially invited. At this meeting, Spingarn, who apparently is quite a great speaker, compared the social workers who kept race off the agenda to the institutions of the early 19th century that remained silent about slavery. And he urged his listeners to join them in the battle, quote, against the erection of a monstrous caste system in America. Testing the waters in a region where they thought Booker T. Washington may be held, still held considerable sway, this was 1914, Washington still alive, Du Bois and Spingarn urged Washington supporters not to shut out the NAACP, that the NAACP had something to offer as well. Du Bois told the packed audience, quote, the Negro will need every weapon he can get hold of in his fight for freedom, economic resources, education, and most of all, political power. Du Bois reported back that the people in this church were on their feet in response to every message of hope and courage that was delivered. And he said, the association's work in the South has begun. The NAACP, one of the many surprises I learned in researching the history, operated literally on a shoestring. They scraped for money. Up to the 1950s, labor never gave much money until the 60s. But in the early days, it was really hand to mouth. And so they're very lean, and they depended on the bold vision, talent, and energy of a handful of dedicated individuals during these early years who created weapons and strategies for a long-term fight and a growing membership base. And, you know, when you get into the papers, one thing you see through them, through their field reports, and they wrote a lot and the organization saved everything, what they're working to grasp the totality of racial prejudice and discrimination across the United States. And in concert with that, develop a flexible and improvisational operation through an expansive program of field work to challenge racial barriers and claim full citizenship rights. Du Bois, from early on, as has been mentioned, really worked towards rooting the NAACP in local communities through the crisis, which he launched in November of 1910. It's remarkable. He got news from all corners of the country as people were moving. And I guess, you know, he had former students, connections. And the crisis really profiled the lives and struggles of black people as migration steadily altered the contours of race in America. He said his magazine was bringing together people who have never seen each other, but simply have racial discrimination as a point of contact. building on the crisis was from the beginning a very active program of field work. It means going out into the countryside, talking to people, and seeing what's happening. And this really exposed a New York-based officials, and again, very few people, to conditions around the country as they worked, in the words of Du Bois, to federate and organize the local battle against race prejudice. There were two extraordinary women early on, Mae Nerney, a woman of Irish descent who was executive secretary in the mid-teens, a former librarian, and Catherine Magnolia Johnson, an African-American high school teacher who left her job to work as a field worker. They traveled extensively in the early years. Catherine Johnson went to the Deep South. And again, what they're seeing, even as they're trying to tell people about the NAACP and organize a movement that speaks to the various experiences that people are having. Mae Nerney, and I think of, you know, Julian and the SNCC organizers of the 60s, people I've gotten to know, and from them you learned about field work. Mae Nerney said, to the uninitiated, they will never understand the work, what it required to go into the field and organize. It required patience and determination, knowing that, quote, one was plowing the ground and having faith in the future. So connections between communities, local and national leadership, from the start frame the challenges and anchor the work of the NAACP as it moves into multiple arenas, again, from the beginning, the courts, legislative, both national and state legislatures in the north, the realm of public opinion, and field work. And the battles on these fronts, and I want to really move to this pivotal point we talked about this morning, that what happens in the early 30s, but this first 25 years, when you talk about the achievements, it kind of takes it out of what it took to get there. So I'm just going to mention a few things, but imagine, again, this lean, small organization really defining this problem and trying to build a movement to confront racial barriers and expand citizenship rights for all. They go into Washington in 1913 to protest Wilson's expansion of segregation in the federal government, and they stay there. They're a lobbying force from then on up through now. They protest discriminatory bills. Wilson has, he's Southern, he has a Southern administration, Southern is in Congress, and they also in 1917 introduced the first no discrimination clause to a bill that included federal appropriations for agricultural education in the South. That's not the Powell bill, that's the NAACP bill. So they're really experimenting with that and making their presence known, and also using it as a platform. Quadrina mentioned the hearings in 1920 where they went and they testified about voter discrimination and murder during the 1920 presidential election. After women got the right to vote, blacks really turned out in large numbers to vote and were turned away, and they went to Congress, had a hearing, and again, they're putting this on the national agenda. The first major civil rights legislative battle in the 20th century is for anti-lynching legislation. What James Weldon Johnson does over nearly a year-long period is extraordinary. Walter White is getting support throughout the country, governors, heads of universities, and in Congress, it's a Republican majority Congress, Republican president, they get through the House, they almost get it through, and a Southern filibuster, the Republicans collapse, and they don't make it. But they take some satisfaction, again, in putting this issue out here, having it debated and publicized. And in the middle of it, there were several lynchings in the South. There were one a week in the, during this period, one a week. One was of a 15-year-old fellow named Charlie Atkins, who was burned at the stake in Georgia, burned at the stake, and filled with bullet holes. This was in the Washington Post and the New York Times, just as this bill was going through the Senate. So people knew, they had this information before the country. And other things as well. The field work, James Weldon Johnson becomes the first field secretary in 1916. Again, Quadrina talked about his work in the South, and people are ready to join, as Du Bois saw in 1914. And their membership goes from 9,000 to 100,000 by the early 20s. In the South, in 1916, they had 350 members. By 1922, they had 45,000 members in the South. So they're really moving and growing. And at the end of the 20s, James Weldon Johnson announces, we have the machinery in place. And they do. I mean, they have the kind of template, the infrastructure that's going to carry their efforts forward. But what they also see by the early 1930s is that the efforts and achievements, and they had several Supreme Court victories around housing discrimination, a white primary case, I mean, many, a number of major achievements, and also exposing the problem, and very little had changed. The caste system in the South remained impenetrable, and national sentiment, you know, failed to rally behind anti-lynching, et cetera. And this is where the Du Bois, you know, Du Bois is 66 years old in 1934, and he says that in the 25, I mean, the NAACP is founded in response to a race riot in the North, trying to contain, keep racism from spreading north. Du Bois notes in 1934 that racial segregation had become more insistent, more prevalent, and more unassailable by appeal or argument. And he argues for a complete rethinking of strategy. Francille talked a bit about what he had advocated. And he really also advocated that, you know, it's not working to try and, you know, work interracially so much. We need to work through our organizations and our institutions and really, you know, move inward and work that way. Not saying you won't go back into that battle again, but that it's really what they've been trying for the last 25 years didn't get them very far in bringing the nation along. He is forced to resign because this doesn't really fit well with where the NAACP sees where their emphasis needs to be. But at the very same time, Charles Houston, the former dean of Howard Law School, joins the staff as legal counsel in 34. And this is a crisis period. Again, we talked about it this morning. Also, their revenue is down. The Depression, people don't have money. They're operating on around $50,000 a year and really kind of, it's not clear, internal debate, external debate, what to do, where to go. Houston comes in. And he really, his vision of the role of the black lawyer and litigation infuses the NAACP with a new energy in targeting the American caste system at its root. And this, the litigation campaign, joined to a movement building strategy, becomes the engine that really drives the association for the next two decades, while these other battles continue to go on. And I think what's interesting about Houston, he wants to use all black lawyers, right? And he wants to work in black communities. He says the black lawyer is a soldier who will take the battle into the courts and serve as an advisor to the people. And again, it's not an anti-white strategy, but just think it's strategy. Take the lawyers, go south. And really, they had a grant from the American Public Service Committee that was $100,000, reduced to $10,000. So he's got a little bit of money, and he begins to build this program. And of course, most blacks can't vote in the 1930s. A great majority live in the South. So the idea of going into the courts and really getting people involved in that way, you know, is a very compelling idea. And as Dean of Howard, he had already begun training these soldiers, Thurgood Marshall, Oliver Hill, a host of young black attorneys. And he's looking out to people, you know, who's around out in the South. There aren't many, but he really makes an appeal. And he envisions a protracted battle, one that would marry legal brilliance, the legal brilliance of black lawyers with the aspirations, civic ideals, and courage of black people around the South. He told a young potential law student in 1935 that the possibilities were limitless for young lawyers who, quote, embraced the opportunity for service and accepted the risks of working on a social frontier. As he saw it, this is 1935, the Negro lawyer in the South in the next 25 years has a chance to reconstruct the entire Southern picture. During his first year as special counsel, he traveled 22,000 miles, again, looking, listening, connecting, investing conditions, filming school disparities in South Carolina, made a 30-minute film. He said the power of the visual to mobilize people is, you know, unsurpassed. It's the first black documentary film of this kind that's made. And most importantly, when he goes into these communities, he meets with teachers, community groups, unions, fraternal organizations, college students. Always, never misses an opportunity to go and meet with college students. My friend John Hope Franklin recalled Houston coming to Fisk, and he said he conveyed in the most powerful way the very critical disadvantages we were living under and their consequences. His presence and his message made a deep impression on me. So he understood the critical importance of building from the base. He told his former student Thurgood Marshall, I am not only a lawyer, but an evangelist and a stump speaker. Marshall joins as his assistant in 1936. Houston described the NAACP as, quote, the crystallizing force of Negro citizenship. Through the legal campaign, you could engage people in their fight as participants, as strategists, as activists, connecting them up with other efforts, stretching the imagination of what was possible. And so he creates an association of attorneys, again, knits them together. Marshall comes on. He's very dynamic. And, you know, I'm going to go forward pretty quickly in this part, but, you know, again, we've talked about the cases, and it's so easy to do a litany of cases and take them out of the context of what it meant to develop these cases, to bring these cases, and his sense of people have to be invested, it's their struggle. And they're not just doing school cases, the criminal justice cases are appalling. And his point was that was basic, because if people couldn't have access to justice in that way, not being railroaded to the electric chair, nothing else mattered too much. So they're working on tremendous, you know, amount of arenas. And again, this is all documented in the field reports. So I think it's essential when we talk about the lawyers, we talk about the legal struggle, that we think about the vision and approach of these attorneys, the nature of their work in these communities, what they saw, and it's documented, they write about it, what they saw, how the process unfolded in the midst of a caste system maintained by terror and violence. And as someone who has lived in these papers, and it's the largest collection at the Library of Congress, you live with the, what they see. And the terror and violence, it is just omnipresent. They face it. They know that people in these communities face it. And the possibility of change in the South of the 1930s and 40s seems very remote. So you really have to will it and join up collectively and begin to sort of enact it. Voting was something they always emphasized. And just to give you a flavor of, you know, how he related to these communities, Houston recounted a meeting in Louisa County with teachers and parents around a school case, and he stressed the importance of paying the poll tax and voting. He promised that he would take the case of any citizen who was denied registration. He said the people responded with great enthusiasm. Quote, they just wanted to know that they would not be left alone in case a fight started. In the aftermath of that meeting, the number of black voters in the county doubled. Houston had a saying, you know, this is no star performance. It's going, the point is we need to impress upon the opposition that we have a program building from the ground up that is ongoing without regard to personnel. You know, he was very egalitarian, not like in a, but no, you know, you had to have everyone sort of ready to move into positions of leadership and make decisions. He, in 1940, shifts out to work on labor cases, and it's early in the war, and he has some political things he wants to get involved with, and Thurgood Marshall, he's totally confident to pass the reins to him. So Marshall takes over, and his work during the 40s, up to 1950, early 1950s, reveals, when you follow him, the extraordinary constraints and challenges, the physical, the psychological, the political challenges they faced as they carve a path to what Du Bois described as the race hatred and national neglect that routinely met their efforts. Marshall outdid Houston. During the early 1940s, he traveled more than 40,000 miles a year. He was hardly ever in New York. And this is true for Ella Baker, who's brought on staff in 41, Madison Jones. Ella Baker and Thurgood Marshall had a great relationship. She'd go to her training conferences, and they were on the same page in terms of organizing. Roy Wilkins wrote once, Thurgood is just back from Texas, Louisiana, Florida, and way stops. He left with a toothbrush, razor, and one shirt, thinking he'd be gone only 2 days, but he's been gone 28. He's leaving tomorrow or the next day for Brownsville, Tennessee, and a stop in Virginia on the way back. Let me say something briefly about Brownsville, Tennessee. You know, we know from Eyes on the Prize and the great work that's been on the 60s, the terror, violence, the casualties in the 60s, how dangerous it was. You know, what, again, emphasizing what it was like in the early 1940s to be on the front lines. And in Brownsville, Tennessee, we see what happens. A new branch is formed in 1940. The group, it's a majority black county, Haywood County, Tennessee. They organize a voter registration effort. The whites in the town just go, they're determined to stop it and to uproot this organization. Albert Williams, a 33-year-old secretary, a group goes to his house late at night. It includes the sheriff. They take him from his home. His body is found in the river 2 days later, looking like Emmett Till, head swollen to twice his size, terrible beating, killed in the river. The NAACP had contacts from Washington, the New Deal, the black vote. They're moving into that arena. They go to the Justice Department. They promise the FBI will investigate. Marshall does his own investigation. The leadership that survived was driven from Brownsville under threat of death. He goes to Chicago, Long Island. The wife of this murdered man is there. He collects affidavits. He puts the whole thing together. And he raises money for the families who were driven out. He says to the members, this is not only a question of mob violence, but it's also a question of our protection of members of this association. Irma Newman, a teacher and a former and a branch member, wrote to the, as this investigation went on, I am on the spot and afraid to stay in my home at night. The Brownsville people are anxiously awaiting and hoping that the law will take its course. After a year and a half, the Justice Department announced insufficient evidence. Marshall was devastated. He pleaded with them. The sheriff was in the group. Here was a clear violation of federal law. And the assistant attorney general said no. He reminded Marshall he was taking peonage cases, but this civil rights division would not touch these voting cases. And this was a clear-cut case. He said as a result of this, the intimidation of blacks who want to register in this particular part of the South would be complete. The war years, the challenges multiply. And we talked a bit this morning, labor cases, as if these lawyers are picking cases. They're living with tremendous demands. And the greatest demands are coming from soldiers serving in a segregated army, where they're being shot by police in the South. The court-martial records, when Constance Baker Motley first goes into Thurgood Marshall's office, she said it was full of court-martial records, just stacked all over the room. Marshall's first case before the Supreme Court was of three black soldiers railroaded for rape in Louisiana. Tried, sentenced to death. He takes to the Supreme Court. It gets transferred to a military trial. Tried, sentenced to death. Roosevelt commutes their sentence. Commutes the sentence, and then they're ultimately pardoned. The cases around soldiers, so many during this time. Cases on labor cases, yes, around the FEPC. The Detroit race riot, where 25 blacks are killed, 17 by the police. This is a total assault on the black community. Marshall and White go to Detroit. Thurgood Marshall sets up a card table in the YMCA and takes affidavits for 2 weeks. He goes and investigates a building which was, he said, looked like a war zone with machine gun holes in the walls and all the rest. So this is what they're facing. And towards the end of the war, he says, despite all that has been done by the NAACP and others, there have been only a few minor changes. The underlying policy of segregation and discrimination is no better, if anything, worse. We are still second-class citizens as civilians and second-class citizens as soldiers and officials in the Army. But the struggle in the South moves forward. Voting is a major arena. Even with the violence, people turn out. Madison Jones, a field worker, took a long trip to the South in the early 40s and said blacks everywhere were making the effort to vote and in many cases succeeding. He told Walter White, you can't understand this sitting in an office in New York. You need to come down. There is a gold mine here if we want to make an investment of concerted action. Marshall brings forward this Texas case. Starts in 1940, goes through the war, and in 1944, Smith v. Allwright is decided by the Supreme Court, finally overturning the white primary. This has been going on for 20 years, a series of cases. And the response is enormous of people turning up to vote. 1946, tremendous violence and resistance. 5 people are murdered in Georgia. In Mississippi, blacks are met with guns at many of the registration polls. But what happens after? In Mississippi, there's a hearing. They petition. They tell that they've been threatened and barred from the polls. A Senate committee comes to Mississippi. Senator Ellender from Louisiana heads it. They won't subpoena witnesses. You have to volunteer to testify. So it really puts you on the spot. Charles Houston went down to cover this. He reported more than 200 blacks turned up to voluntarily testify, regardless of possible reprisals against property, businesses, and families. And then he said, for the first time in 50 years, a stinking record of terror and intimidation has been exposed in a statewide hearing. South Carolina, they resist. They have to go to court twice. 1948, Judge Wadey's Wearing said, it's done, and if you Democrats don't obey the law, you're going to jail. So people could vote in the primary in South Carolina. The number of registered black voters went from 3,500 to 50,000. So they're seeing this response, right? Around this time, Charles Houston goes to New York for a meeting of the National Legal Team. And he writes a wonderful piece comparing the scene in this office. When he went in 1934, he was the only lawyer. There were 5 people in the office. He recites the names of the NAACP-affiliated lawyers attending the meeting, demonstrating the strategic reach of the association. Bulwer was up from South Carolina. Loeb from Nashville. Hill Martin and Robinson from Virginia. Neighbor and Lawson from D.C. Shores from Birmingham. Ming from Chicago. This is his team. He notes that all are directing various phases of the fight in discrimination in education, employment, transportation, housing, voting, and criminal law. As always, he said, the volume of the work exceeded the capacity of this small, tightly organized group on the cutting edge of law with roots in all parts of the country. Quote, they labored in the knowledge, in Houston's words, that they could barely scratch the surface of the needs of our people for legal protection. So never enough. Now this is, you know, Larissa Ferguson talked about the school cases. Education from the beginning, the first editorial in the Crisis is about school segregation, that was fundamental to everything else. And when they pushed, as Larissa explained, into going up against segregation, when Marshall told people in South Carolina, this was, they're moving into that phase in 47, he said they looked at him and they didn't clap, you know, because this was going all the way. And what's remarkable is within 4 years, South Carolina was at the head of this. They tried the first case in Brown in Charleston, and I'm almost to the end, but I just want to read, those of you who've heard me read before have heard this, but this scene says everything about what has happened in the course of this litigation movement building campaign. Before dawn on the morning of May 28, 1941, the first day of the trial, Eliza Briggs met her neighbors at St. Mark's Church in Somerton and joined a caravan of cars headed for Charleston. Black men and women began lining up outside the federal courthouse at sunrise and continued coming all day. By the time the lawyers arrived, the line stretched from the second-story courtroom down the hall and stairway, through the lobby, down the front steps, and along the sidewalk. The courtroom seated 150, more than 500 people waited, and more came. Eliza Briggs was guaranteed a seat, given that the case bore her family's name. James Gibson, a farmer who rode over from Clarendon County, was among the hundreds who lined up outside. I never got tired of standing that day, he said. During the course of the trial, news found its way to Gibson and others gathered along the hallway and on the street. Whenever the NAACP lawyer made a point, reporter Ted Poston recalled, someone got up and whispered it to the line, and it would travel right down the corridor and down the steps to the throng outside. A month later, Marshall was talking about the case. They lost, but they were taking it to the Supreme Court, and they figured they'd get the constitutional ruling they wanted. But the significance to him, he said, the Negroes from Clarendon County and all over the South jammed the courthouse, standing shoulder to shoulder, hot and uncomfortable, for a single purpose, to demonstrate to all the world that Negroes in the South are determined to eliminate segregation from American life. So as we know, massive resistance meets the Brown decision, but that spirit he saw standing outside the courthouse, the people who turned up in Mississippi in 46, that couldn't be contained. They could outlaw the NAACP, they could do all that, but this was moving forward. And shortly before Charles Houston passed away in 1950, he talked about the change in the NAACP. Writing on the state of the organization, he said, if I were forced to choose the most important single development in the NAACP, I would not select specific legal victories, as important as they are, but the change in the NAACP from a pilot leadership organization to a mass organization. The NAACP is no longer merely a group of intellectuals talking about remote ideals, but a mass movement of average citizens spread over the face of the land, determined to make democracy work at all levels. So I'm going to wrap it up, but I think what I've tried to do here, as a historian of the civil rights movement, it really, especially after writing this book and researching this book, it astounds me how the work of these lawyers, the intellectual capital of the civil rights movement, is either overlooked, except for very few scholars, marginalized, or dissected in a very narrow, contained framework. Brown, the culmination of two decades of litigation and organizing, has been subject to intense scrutiny separate from a full analysis of the historical context and conditions that produced it. And as many have noted, Brown was the foundation. I mean, the court's ruling outlawing segregation created the space for the mass movement, but the work of these attorneys with local leaders and local people created the spirit, the energy, the determination to move into that space and carry the movement forward through the 60s to the final dismantling of Jim Crow and the civil rights legislation that NAACP lobbyists helped to shape over the previous decades. So I think the legacy of the NAACP is so much in its history and what it has to teach us today. We ask about where do we go, what should we do? And there's a wonderful quote from C.L.R. James where he says, let all believers in democracy and equality today strengthen ourselves by studying what they did, and this is the important part, and how they did it. Thank you.